It's 9:06. Good morning. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Kathleen will be back on Monday. Well, two topics in this first hour of today's program. We'll start by taking a look at who went to jail as a result of the mortgage market meltdown, and more importantly, who didn't. I'll tell you what, if there isn't steam coming out of your ears by 9:30 this morning, there should be. Then after 9:30, we'll shift gears just a little bit. It's the tax season. Many of us have already filed and gotten our refunds, but for some, April 15th still looming. Do you cheat on your taxes? Well, we won't ask for a show of hands. Chances are, if you're single, young, and male, well, you're more likely to cheat than others. We'll talk about who cheats on their taxes after 9:30. Last month, a column in the New York Times had this headline: Biggest fish face little risk of being caught. The column described how Angelo Mozzillo, the former head of Countrywide Mortgage, had escaped prosecution for fraud. A month later, the same columnist wrote another piece about a much lesser known and much less wealthy figure who went to jail for taking what is known as a liar loan. We're going to spend the next few minutes talking with the person who wrote those columns, and I hope we'll get some insight into why no one went to jail for the financial fraud, at least none of the big guys, that launched the second biggest recession in American history. My guest is Joe Nocera, business columnist for the New York Times. He also contributes to the New York Times Magazine as a business writer. And in addition to his work at the Times, he serves as a regular business commentator for NPR's Weekend Edition with Scott Simon. Good morning and welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Well, pretty good so far, but the day is young. We have to leave room for things to happen. Federal prosecutors spent more than 2 years investigating the former head of Countrywide Mortgage and then decided, we won't do anything. So let's start there. The average person looks at this as pretty cut and dried that, well, gee whiz, there had to be some fraud someplace, didn't there? And we all wonder why, for example, the head of Countrywide isn't on trial. Why is that?
Here's why. They are, to give the government their due, these are difficult. Those are difficult cases to prosecute. The way the law works, you can run a company that makes tons of sleazy loans, but if you don't make them yourself, you're not really liable for them. And so the only thing they really could get on Mozzillo or attempt to get on Mozzillo was lying to investors about the quality of Countrywide's portfolio. And in the end, they concluded that the disclosures, not that you and I would read those disclosures, but the disclosures they'd made in their various financial filings did, in fact, meet the incredibly flimsy standard required to avoid getting thrown in jail or getting prosecuted. There's a second reason as well, which is that the federal government did try one early case of the two men who ran the Bear Stearns hedge fund that went under, and that was kind of a precursor to the financial crisis. And guess what? They were found innocent by a jury of their peers. And I think that that verdict has frightened prosecutors and made them worry about bringing other cases.
Okay, but didn't this fellow, Mr. Mozzillo, also basically dump his stock when he saw that it was going to tank and walk away with hundreds of millions of dollars? Isn't that prosecutable?
Yes, it is. If you can prove that he dumped his stock with the knowledge that the stock was about to tank. But again, I do not want to be in a position of defending Angelo Mozzillo here. I think he's one of the people who brought us to the brink of disasters, and I think he remains delusional today, to this day, about the damage his company did. But having said that, it's a really hard case to prosecute. Did he really know the stock was going to tank? You know, what was going on in his mind? Did he have some kind of program that he had set up to do automated selling of his stock, which many CEOs do, and that's kind of a way to avoid legal liability? You can say, listening to me now, that the system is rigged for the big guys, and I'm not going to disagree, but that is the way things are right now.
Well, was there anything in the financial reform legislation that Congress passed, it seems like forever ago, that would make it harder for people to do stuff like this in the future or easier to prosecute them for it?
No.
Wow.
And, I've heard some people suggest that maybe they should bring RICO suits like they did against the mafia in the old days, and I haven't looked into that enough to really know. I've also heard that if the prosecutors were sort of more focused on this and more aggressive about it, they could have had a better, at least try to prosecute some of these cases. That's a little hard to know either. I will say this. I'm sure you're aware there's a big insider trading case going on right now in New York City involving a wealthy Sri Lankan hedge fund guy, Raj. I can't even pronounce his last name.
Yeah.
And the reason I bring that up is because he, long before the financial crisis hit, and even before Bernie Madoff hit, the Southern District of New York, the U.S. attorney there, had really put his chips on this insider trading case. And he devoted a lot of his sort of financial crime resources to these wiretaps and this investigation and all that stuff. And I actually think that one reason so little has been done in prosecuting the bigwigs in the financial crisis and the bigwigs surrounding Bernie Madoff is that the Southern District of New York, he just doesn't have the resources because he's used them all on this insider trading case.
Wow.
You don't sound too happy.
Gee, I wonder how you picked that up. You're very perceptive. This whole thing from day one, and I'm not the only one. I think I'm speaking for a lot of people in our audience when we look at stuff like this, and I mean this just does not pass the sniff test. You had people who knew things were bad, and I mean there were people who just didn't think and did stuff because I can make a dollar, so this must be okay. But you know that there were people who knew that the roulette wheel was fixed to stop at a certain place, and they got out before everything went bad. And the average person, you know, looking at this says, you know what, somebody needs to pay for this because the rest of us pretty much got the shaft. You know, and there's a lot of people who lost a lot of stuff that they'll never get back.
I don't disagree with that. I mean, that's very, very true.
And, well, I think I better open up the phone lines because otherwise I'm going to go on a rant and then I'll probably end up having to go back into the retail grocery business, which I don't really want to do. 800-486-8655 is the number to call if you'd like to weigh in on this subject. The next part of this story, if you aren't already upset, is really going to nail you. 800-486-8655. You can send an email to talk@WPR.org. There's also a Kathleen Dunn Facebook fan page. You can leave a comment there, and we'll turn it into radiation. While federal prosecutors decided not to make Mr. Mozzillo and others of his ilk do the perp walk, they had no reluctance at going after some small players in this tragedy. Tell us about Charlie Engel.
Well, yeah, this is certainly the situation that got me really quite upset. Charlie Engel is just a guy. You know, he's not a big shot like Angelo Mozzillo. And he's an ultra marathon. He's actually got a certain degree of fame in his little world. And a couple years ago, he did an extraordinary thing. He and two other fellows ran across from west to east across the Sahara, which took them, I think, 3 months. And it was the feat was documented in a film that was produced and financed by Matt Damon. So some guy at the IRS, some criminal investigator, not just a tax auditor, a criminal investigator at the IRS who lives in the same hometown in North Carolina, hears about the documentary and he says to himself, gee, how does he make his money if he's training for ultra marathons? And on that basis, he begins a criminal tax investigation. That is the basis. I mean, so right there, you know, you've got an incredible situation where, I mean, it makes you wonder, I mean, if the IRS could do that to him, they could do it to anybody. They can't find anything tax-wise on him. They dumpster dive. They follow him around. They surveillance. that can't get anything on him for taxes. He apparently pays his taxes, or at least what he owes. So they wire up some good-looking IRS agent, and she starts a flirtatious relationship with him. And she says to him, "How do you invest? How do you make money on your investments?" And he says, "Oh well," he said, "I'm not really proud of this, but you know, my mortgage broker a couple of times put some numbers on a piece of paper saying I made more than I made." And on the basis of that, he's in jail for 21 months for lying on a liar loan, allegedly lying. And the facts get even more complicated when you sort of look into it. There are serious questions as to whether he did a lie on the liar loan or whether his signature was forged in a couple of places and so on and so forth. But my point is, you know, it really does feel like there is justice for the big guy, or lack of justice for the big guys, and just this ridiculous miscarriage of justice for the little guys that makes the prosecutors, you know, think like they're doing something about mortgage fraud when all they're really doing is, you know, basically putting people in jail for no good reason.
Well, when it's obvious that if you have money, you can do anything you want, and if you don't have money, you can expect the government's boot on your neck, that's not very good for the republic, is it?
It's terrible for the republic. You know, I hate to say this. I don't want to sound like a lunatic here. But, you know, I've written a bunch of columns about the rule of law, or lack thereof, in Russia. And I've primarily written about Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who's in jail on trumped-up charges of tax evasion because Putin doesn't like him. And he was once the richest man in Russia. And you watch this case, and you watch certain cases like this, and you do have to say to yourself, you know, what kind of rule of law do we have here?
Yeah, you do. We have the rule of the phones here, and we have full phones, and we don't have a lot of time with you this morning, so I want to get some callers in here. Let's get one in before the break. Anyway, we'll start with Barb in Fond du Lac. Barb, good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for having this guest on. I just commented about Griftopia and Matt Taibbi, but I also want to ask the question, why is it that our federal government is not deciding to pass laws that close loopholes and allow these people to be prosecuted? It's just, here we are quibbling over millions, billions of dollars at the federal level, and people like this are not being dealt with. It's just crazy.
Well, I mean, I don't disagree, but, you know, you also have the issue of the Supreme Court, which recently ruled that one such law, which is called the Honest Services Statute, is unconstitutional. Honest Services was a great way for prosecutors to kind of nab, you know, crooked executives when they had a hard time, you know, coming up with, you know, as I say, the, you know, it's difficulty. These guys, you know, lead their companies into the abyss, and then they walk away scot-free. So the Honest Services is one of the ways, for instance, Jeff Skilling and Enron got prosecuted. It's not the only way, but it's one of the ways. And the Supreme Court has now ruled that the Honest Services thing is too vague and is therefore unconstitutional. So, you know, on some level, it's a little hard. it's a little hard to blame it all on Congress, given the drift of the courts. Having said that, it does seem to me there's something manifestly wrong with a situation where your company, I mean, what's going on countrywide is that they're being sued like crazy right now by all the people, all the investors who bought their crummy loans, basically saying these loans were fraudulent. You knew they were fraudulent. And I have a hard time understanding how you can run a company that makes billions of dollars in fraudulent loans and not be liable for it. That's to me the real mystery here.
We need to get to a break, and we'll come back. I know we have a lot of callers, and unfortunately for us, Joe Nocera, you have to leave at about 9:30, but we'll see how many people we can get in between now and then.
Okay,
I'm John
great.
Munson. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 22 minutes after 9 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. Kathleen will be back on Monday. My guest in this part of the program, and we only have him for about another 10 minutes, is Joe Nocera, business columnist for The New York Times. He wrote a number of columns recently that really caught my attention. We're talking about how, the big guys get to walk and the little guys go to jail, and why that is. We've got a lot of callers. Let's go next to Bill in Sun Prairie. Bill, thanks for joining us.
John and Jonah, thank you so much for bringing this to our attention. Far more, I think, focus should be on this in the news, and it just seems like it's totally neglected. A few comments. Number one, I know this must be a difficult job to prosecute, but, you know, when I was in business, if my boss, if I told my boss, you know, this is going to be a difficult job, he'd have laughed at me. You know, that's my job. I need to do it. Secondly, I suspect that one of the reasons why there hasn't been more attention paid to this is that didn't Countrywide, for instance, cut a lot of loans to politicians? I mean, sweet deals. So, I mean, I think the Congress's hands are somewhat dirty on all this. You know, it comes back to this old Latin proverb, who guards the guards?
Yeah. They did have a Friends of Angelo program. We didn't touch a lot about it in the book I wrote with Bethany McLean, All the Devils Are Here. How about that for a plug? But it did exist. However, one of the things you need to understand is that the prosecutors love going after guys who are tied with politicians. It's a badge of honor, and it helps them get a fancy corporate it helps them get a well-paying job later, because it's a reputation maker that gets them in the headlines a lot. So while it certainly might affect Congress's ability or willingness to write laws that would put these guys in jail, it doesn't really affect the prosecutorial drive to get these guys.
The Latin quotation that our caller was referring to, of course, quis custodiat ipsos custodis, from the Roman poet Juvenal. It's public radio, so I had to bring that up. Tom in Burlington is next.
On your point about, there's an old saying that says, be careful who you choose to be your enemy, because you will become just like your enemy. And that Russia was you're saying the connection between America and Russia. We've become very close as far as that's concerned. I wanted to point this out, though. It seems to me that the upper echelon does not get prosecuted. For instance, in 9/11, there was no one prosecuted for the tremendous disaster in the intelligence department for what happened there, and no one was even fired. Mr. Munson, you and I talked in 2006 about the problem with the real estate business. The appraisers were never held accountable for the numbers that they gave when they appraised a piece of property. So that the bankers always had an out. They said, well, the appraiser said it was worth this, and so there's no accountability or incentive to be honest.
Well, I'm not going to argue with that. Joe Nocera?
I don't really have a lot to add to that.
Okay. Well, then let's go to Mark in Ashland, because we're running out of time. Mark, good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, thanks for putting me on. Very interesting show. I have a question for the guest. If truly that the rule of law no longer belongs to the people and it is owned by the corporation and the money, what happens to countries where this happens, where the rule of law is destroyed by the rich and the powerful? What historically happens next?
Well, you know, first of all, I don't think we're as dire as that entirely. But you know, what happens when people stop believing in the rule of law, you move towards a society where, you know, people are much more willing to it becomes a more cynical society that doesn't really believe in the law And it's much more of an every person for themselves, and there's no sense of shared sacrifice. Russia is a really good example of that, where, you know, the corruption is so off the charts high. The wealthy and the plutocrats and the people who are friendly with Putin get away with everything. And the society, as a result, it's a very corrosive aspect of society. There's not a lot of job generation because nobody wants to start a company because you got to pay bribes. And if you get on the wrong side of the politicians, they throw you in jail, so you lose, you know, sort of basic freedoms. And, I don't think we're at that point yet. I'm certainly hopeful that we won't get to that point, but it is discouraging what is happening in the country.
Here's a Facebook comment from Michael, who says, sadly, more people know what seed at the NCAA teams that the NCAA teams were and could care less about the backstory of the financial crisis. Bread and circuses? I mean, we're more interested in our bracket, and we feel maybe worse about that than the fact that that there were a number of individuals who crashed the entire economy and then walked away.
That's true. I think one of the things that has gone on in this country between the political fights in Wisconsin, the financial crisis, the political wars in Washington is that I do think there's a lot more attention given to that than there has been in the past. So I understand where the listener is coming from, but I think there's a pretty heightened awareness right now of the mess that we're in.
Well, I think you do have to grant that we're all probably a lot more cynical than we'd like to be.
Yeah, I think that is probably true.
And since I was born a cynic, I really didn't have a whole long way to go. I'd like to. I know you have to leave fairly quickly, and I really hope we can have you back sometime when we can spend the whole hour talking about some of these issues. But if you were emperor for a day, what do you think we could do to fix this?
Well, what do you mean by this?
Well, the idea that people can simply crash, you know, run this whole thing into the ditch and then walk away and say, well, it wasn't my fault. Somebody else did it.
Okay. Number one, I think you should have a system that really allows the federal government to go after your money in cases like this. Not some stupid $20 million fine that's a slap on the wrist when you're as wealthy as Angelo Mozilla. But just a system that basically says, look, your profits were generated fraudulently. Therefore, you know, we have a right to everything you ever made. I think that would be that alone would be a gigantic disincentive for these guys to do wrong things in the first place. And then it would give the government a tremendous amount of leverage to go after them after the fact. I think that's a really simple thing that we could do.
And I think we're probably going to have to leave it there because I know you have to run. But I really appreciate it.
Listen, thank you very much for having me, and I would love to come on again if you wanted to have me again.
Oh, I already sent a note to the producers to make sure that there's a big sticky note on your card in the Rolodex. Have this guy back soon.
Thanks so much.
Okay, thank you. Joe Nocera is a business columnist for the New York Times. He also contributes to the New York Times Magazine as a business writer. In addition to his work at The Times, he serves as a regular business commentator for NPR's Weekend Edition with Scott Simon, and he joined us by phone. Thanks so much to Chrissy Pease for arranging his presence on the program this morning. Okay, well, we're going to change topics. For the rest of this hour of the show, and I'm sorry, I know that there were people who wanted to get in on the topic we just left, but we will come back to this. This is a story that's not going to go away, and I know there were some comments that I didn't get to, and I'm sorry, but we're moving to a different topic now. Okay. So, as I said at the top of the program, well, April 15th is coming up, and if you haven't filed your tax forms, you should at least be thinking about it. So it's a good time to talk about tax cheating. And if you have enough money, you don't have to cheat because you can hire a cadre of lawyers and accountants who will spend quite a bit of time and treasure to find tax shelters for you. For others, however, it's maybe easier just to fudge a few numbers here or there and create a better outcome, take a chance that you won't get audited, knowing that the IRS is understaffed and under budget. Our tax system, though, relies pretty much on the honesty of citizens who understand that they have an obligation to pay their taxes. A recent article on CNN.com described the typical American tax cheat, male, single, and under the age of 45. Well, it lets me off the hook then. My guest for the rest of this hour is Joel Slimrod, Paul W. McCracken Collegiate Professor of Business, Economics, and Public Policy, Professor of Economics at the University of Michigan, and co-author of Taxing Ourselves, A Citizen's Guide to the Great Debate Over Tax Reform. He joins me by phone. Good morning, Professor, and welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Well, what do you make of this survey suggesting that young single males are most likely to cheat on their taxes? Is it does it mean anything in particular?
Well, we know quite a bit about the pattern of tax evasion due to some comprehensive studies that the IRS has done over the last 20 or 30 years, and the data do suggest that on average, younger, married, and male people have a higher rate of evasion. Overall, the IRS thinks that for the income tax, about slightly less than 14% of what should be paid is not. So the overall tax gap, as the IRS calls it, is about 14% of total true tax liability.
But that's a pretty big number when you put it in dollar terms. I mean, we're talking about billions here.
Oh, hundreds of billions, for sure. Yes, it's a big number. If that number could go to zero, then everybody's tax rates could go down, and we wouldn't collect any less revenue. The problem is it's not easy to think of acceptable ways to get the number down that much.
Well, what I was wondering when I read the article was how many people taking their survey just didn't admit to fudging a bit on their Form 1040. What you're saying is the IRS believes that about 14% of us cheat, or is it just that a lot of us cheat, but the revenue amounts to about 14% of what they should be collecting?
Yeah, it's the second. The 14% number is a number of dollars, the percentage of dollars that should be sent in that isn't. The IRS also thinks that more than half of individual income taxpayers understate their tax by at least a little bit. So it is a lot of people seem to understate a little bit, and it adds up to about 14% of what should be sent in.
Pennies turn into dollars, and dollars turn into millions and then billions when you spread it across the whole population. Is part of the problem the fact that our tax system is so complicated? I mean, on the one hand, it can make it easy to make a mistake. On the other hand, it can also make it easy to find a place where you might be able to fudge a little bit of money.
Yeah, I think complexity does matter for the size and the nature of the tax gap. Both aspects of that that you mentioned matter some. I think the fact that a complex tax system means that people make mistakes is certainly true. But if that's all it were, we would expect to see sort of as many overstatements of tax liability as understatements, as people try to get it right but just, you know, err on one side or the other. And that's not what we see. So I think complexity can mean more mistakes and people not paying what they ought to pay, but I don't think that can explain the magnitude of the tax gap. The second aspect, I think, is also an issue that the tax system, for a lot of people, not for everybody, has gotten so complicated that just means there are more loopholes and ways to get around tax liability. But, you know, there's a difference between legal loopholes, which economists call tax avoidance, and outright noncompliance or tax evasion. And these tax gap numbers are only about evasion, noncompliance, not about illegal avoidance.
What's the most common way that people cheat on their taxes? I'm going to make a guess here and suggest that it's probably the underreporting of income.
Yes, underreporting of income is, according to the IRS, about 80% of the total tax gap. Non-filing, so just not filing at all, is a little bit less than 10%. But you're right. It's the understated income that's the biggest percentage of the overall tax gap. And among that, it's the problem is clearly much bigger for self-employed people compared to employees.
Well, I would suppose that there are a number of types of businesses that are pretty cash intensive. You don't have a lot of credit card transactions necessarily. Or maybe, you know, you've just got a lot of cash coming across the counter. It would be pretty simple, I would think, to put some of that away and just not report it.
Yeah, that apparently is the case. So the IRS thinks the non-compliance rate for self-employed businesses is 57% compared to just over 1% for employees. You know, if you're an employee, you might think about not reporting your wages and salaries, but if you're paying attention, you know that your employer is telling the IRS how much they paid you and what your Social Security number is. So you don't have the opportunities if you are so inclined to non-comply.
If you'd like to join us and talk about this issue, why do we feel that it's, well, you know, it's just our taxes. I shouldn't have to pay because I'd rather have more money to shop on eBay or something. Or you just maybe think that, well, the government wastes my money anyway. Why should I pay? Or maybe you think, hey, you know what? We ought to go after tax cheaters and make sure that everybody pays what they're supposed to. And then we would all be able to have lower taxes, or there wouldn't be as big a budget deficit. 800-486-8655 is the number to call. We've already got some callers in the queue, and we'll go to calls in just a moment. 800-486-8655, the email address talk@wpr.org. There's also a Kathleen Dunn Facebook fan page, and you can leave a message there for us, and we'll try and share it with the audience. We do have a call. Let's take a call before we go to our first break in this portion of the program. We'll start with Dave in Menominee.
Hi, Dave, good morning.
Good morning.
My question's about the offshore subsidiaries, you know, the tax havens. President Obama last year, 2 years ago, I think, said he was going to crack down on these tax havens. I remember him talking about check-the-box rules where they can make their subsidiaries or cash disappear overseas. Is he still on track with those, do you know? Or has that been derailed and somehow taken off the table?
Well, the whole issue of the corporation tax, and especially for multinationals, is very much alive. Apparently, the Treasury is working on a tax reform proposal. What it will say about tax havens is unclear, but I do think it will certainly address this issue. There's no question that multinationals make use of tax havens to lower their worldwide tax burden. Some of it is perfectly legal, and we suspect some of it is at least at the blurry line between legal and illegal. And it's not only multinational companies. There's been a lot of evidence and controversy recently that high-income individuals park some of their money and put their credit cards in tax havens in part to avoid or evade, in this case, their tax liabilities.
Dave, thanks for the call. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll have probably some more callers who want to weigh in on this subject. We're talking about taxes today. The genesis for this half of the program, an article on CNN.com describing the most likely person to cheat on taxes as male, single, and under the age of 45. We know that the tax gap amounts to hundreds of billions of dollars every year, money that the Treasury doesn't get because people underreport their income, fail to file their tax forms at all, or just to find ways to, well, cheat themselves, really, because we are the government, if you want to think about this metaphysically. We're continuing to discuss that until 10 o'clock this morning. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. That's the toll-free number you can use to join our discussion this morning. You can also use the email address talk@WPR.org, or you can go to the Kathleen Dunn Facebook fan page, leave a message there, and I'll share it with the audience. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9:43. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Next hour, we're going to talk about, well, there's a new biography out of an absolutely fascinating individual, and I'm sure many of you will recognize the name, Alan Lomax. The title of the biography, Alan Lomax, The Man Who Recorded the World, written by John Zwed. We'll have John Zwed with us in the next hour to talk about, well, I don't want to get too far into that, but it's, I think you will enjoy the hour. I know I've enjoyed reading this biography. This hour, we started talking about, in the first half of the hour, talking about how some people involved in the financial meltdown got to go free, and others, much smaller fry, ended up in prison. This half of the hour, we're talking about taxes and why we cheat on them, and probably more than half of us underreport our income or do something else to avoid paying what we actually owe, and this amounts to hundreds of billions of dollars that the Treasury doesn't collect every year, and that is a big deal. My guest in this portion of the program is Joel Slemrod, Paul W. McCracken, Collegiate Professor of Business Economics and Public Policy and Professor of Economics at the University of Michigan. He's also the co-author of Taxing Ourselves, A Citizen's Guide to the Great Debate Over Tax Reform. Well, Professor, we've got some callers, and I'm going to go to another call here in just a moment. But before we do, I wanted to put this out there. Our tax system really, really does rely on voluntary compliance. I mean, the IRS, even in the days when they were really aggressive at going after, you know, everybody, I mean, we were really all afraid of the IRS, and so we complied, made sure that our tax forms were correct when we turned them in because nobody wanted to be audited. But if no one, you know, there are audits, but it seems like a lot of people get away with it. And we look at corporations like General Electric, which paid no taxes last year, basically. And people say, well, you know, why shouldn't I get a piece of this? If people get the idea that they really don't have to pay their taxes or pay all of them, the system is really in trouble, isn't it?
Sure, that's true, though I wouldn't really characterize it as being based on voluntary compliance. I think it's really voluntary plus. I mean, there are this system of information reporting so that the IRS knows, for example, what your wages and salaries are, your interest, dividends, and audits that they do to back up the system. So there's no question if the more people that dutifully pay their taxes without thinking about noncompliance makes it easier and less costly to collect taxes, but it's a lot more than voluntary.
We have John in Madison who wants to join us. Let's hear what John has to say. John, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Pretty good. Go ahead.
Very timely and interesting topic. My concern, I think a lot of people in my category, is that the tax system has a fundamental unfairness to it. For example, I happen to be a single individual with a reasonable income, not very high. It's well below $100,000 a year. But I happen to be, you know, every time I put my taxes in and I see the average, what supposedly the average family or individual pays in this country, I happen to be paying at least four times more than the average. And of course, we all know how little or how half the country doesn't pay anything at all when it comes to all the deductions and credits. And so when you look at this, there is a, you know I should be paying something. I should be paying for the defense. I should be paying for the justice system, for police, and all the services we get from the government. But it seems like I should not be the only one. And nor should the rich be the only ones paying, for that matter. You know, I'm not rich, but I think there is a system, you know, there is a fairness element that should be that is a major part of this voluntary compliance thing, you know, in terms of trying to avoid, so that people don't, you know, do the least to avoid paying what they owe. And so that the government has to spend the least amount actually collecting from people who should be paying.
Well, I certainly understand that and agree that it's easier to pay your taxes dutifully without thinking about compliance if you have a sense that the tax burden is distributed fairly across people, as long as we recognize that not everybody agrees on and what is a fair distribution of the tax burden. It's interesting, though, that there's really not a lot of evidence that suggests that an individual's beliefs about how fair the tax system is affects their own compliance behavior. I think it certainly contributes to a malaise if and may get you thinking about evading on your taxes, but not a whole lot of evidence suggests it makes a big difference when people sit down and decide about their tax liability.
Thanks. Thanks for that call, John. Let's go next to Tim in Ladysmith.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Interesting program. A couple points. I think first of all, you know, when you say it's voluntary compliance, your guest made the point it's anything but voluntary, because if you avoid taxes in the United States, you're going to go to prison. I mean, I know people that are in prison for greater amounts of time for evading taxes than they would for murdering somebody. So it's ruthless. And dealing with the IRS, I don't see that the IRS has become any more lenient in people. You know, if you make a mistake, you're going to get major penalized. If the IRS makes a mistake, you get 1% on this minimal amount of evasion. I don't agree with people evading taxes by any means, but the system itself needs to be reformed. It's not just your income tax we're talking about paying. We're paying taxes, I think it's, 180 days or something like that out of the year before we pay our tax burden. So it's outrageous, and we need major tax reformation. Like what Mike Huckabee suggested, let's get rid of the Internal Revenue Service because it's not really part of the federal government. And I'm against it in every way, shape, or form, and I think that's the sentiment of most Americans because so much of our money is wasted, like your former caller just said. So it's outrageous. Thanks.
Tim, thanks for the call. Professor?
Well, there's lots of tax reform plans on the table now that might address some of the caller's concerns. The caller said that although he doesn't agree with the way the tax system is now, he's against evasion. And it turns out most Americans feel the same about evasion. If you ask people whether they think tax evasion, if you have a chance, is acceptable, the vast majority of people say it isn't. And so we have to separate, I think, our views as citizens and voters about what we think the right tax system is, and then our duties as a citizen to pay the taxes we owe.
Well, the survey cited in the CNN article, though, pointed out that we may all have different ideas of what constitutes evasion. You know, what I'm doing is okay, but what you're doing is probably against the law, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that sounds a little bit to me like a rationalization of behavior. I think there are some people who just can't figure out what they really owe. It's very complicated, and so they may end up ex post having understated their tax liability. But I think most of the people who are evading know full well what they're into.
Let's see, Wayne in Annawa, you'll be next.
Yes,
Wayne, good morning.
Thank you. I hang around with a bunch of small, independent, self-employed people. And a lot of them are doing barter now. They're trying to trade their services for something else and trying to avoid a little bit of the tax because they're so sick of seeing their tax dollars being wasted and them being taxed to the point where the big corporations don't pay anything, and it's on the news every day. And the other thing they object to is that they've seen their tax dollars go toward tax breaks and credits for big business, and they've used their tax dollars to move their companies out of this country. And now they feel They're not here paying the tax base anymore, and they're loading up a bigger tax base on the small business, when if I'd only been a big business, I could have got those big tax breaks and done something with them, too. So there's a great injustice here, and it's gotten worse over the last few years because of the publicity that these big corporations have got with avoiding taxes and with moving out of this country. That's all I had.
Well, the caller brings to mind the old saying that the poor evade and the rich avoid. There's no question that there's more flexibility in legal avoidance loopholes, aggressive tax planning for high-income people and for multinational corporations. And for those citizens who think the tax burden is spread unfairly, there are a lot of tax reform plans out there on the table now that may get a serious hearing over the year, next year or two, that address the kinds of issues that the last couple callers have brought up.
Pat in Ripon, you're next. Good morning, Pat.
Good morning. I have a question, and how do you report tax fraud when you're aware of it? We know some people that cashed in two custodial accounts on their daughters that amounted to over $18,000, kept the money, and are now making their children pay the capital gains tax and the interest, the tax on the interest. These girls didn't even know they had these accounts until they went to go do their taxes, and the parents handed them this. They're estranged from the parents. They'd like the money to pay off college. So I'm wondering, how do you report the tax fraud when you know of it?
Well, there is a actually an IRS form that you can get, and if you suspect an individual or a company that isn't complying with the tax laws, you can fill out the form. You can get it online. It's Form 3949A, and there's an address to mail it to. So there's a simple way to do that.
Pat, thanks for the call, and good luck with that. Jeff in Milwaukee, we'll go to you next.
Good morning to you. The question or comment I have is that I think there's a good percentage of people out there that would like to pay their state and federal tax, but they're just in economical hard times. And I guess the statement I want to make is there a place that these people can go without a cost to them on getting their state and federal tax done for them? I think a lot of these places you go to charge X number of dollars or a percentage of what your income taxes, and I don't think these people could pay, you know, $200, $300 to have them done, so they opt out to not have their taxes done for that reason. I was very curious about that, if there's a place that these people could go, because I think chances are there'd be a percentage of people that would be more than glad to pay their taxes.
Well, there's a number of places. There's at least one place, and I don't want to mention this because I don't want to be seen as endorsing anything, but I know there's at least one fairly reliable web tax services provider that you can get your state and federal income tax forms. If you put the information in, they do all the rest of the work for $15. I've been using it for years, and it's I've never had a problem with it. So it's out there. You just have to look for it. Professor, there are a lot of services people can get access to.
Yeah, and again, also on the IRS website, irs.gov, if you look for free file, there is a way to get a your federal return, not your state return, prepared and e-filed for no cost, and so it's called Free File. It supports some state tax returns, but not all.
Let's see. Oh, let's take a quick call from Mike in Kenosha. And Mike, we're almost out of time.
Okay. My question is, why don't we go to a flat tax with a 10%? Everybody pays 10% on anything you buy. I mean, it eliminates any type of fraud, really, if you think about it, on top of it.
All right. Well, let's let the professor respond to that because we have only about a minute left.
Yeah, 10% wouldn't raise the revenue we're raising now. You can, I think a lot of people would yelp about losing their mortgage interest deduction, et cetera. So I'm certainly willing to consider cleaner, broader tax bases and simpler ways to raise the money we need. But unless you tell me about how we're going to cut our spending vastly, a 10% tax isn't going to do it.
All right, Professor, what could we do to make to help fix this situation of the undercollection of the taxes that people actually do owe?
Yeah, I mean, I think the key is to maintain a reasonable and non-invasive enforcement system, to expand the information reporting so that the IRS knows a little bit more about people's incomes. There's a new form this year, 1099-K, that moves in that direction. But we have to keep in mind that there's really no way that, no acceptable, non-intrusive way to raise all or even most of that tax gap number that I began talking about.
All right. Well, we're out of time. We'll have to leave it there, Professor. Thank you so much for joining
me
this morning.
Thanks.
Joel Slemrod is Paul W. McCracken Collegiate Professor of Business, Economics, and Public Policy, Professor of Economics at the University of Michigan, co-author of Taking a Taxing Ourselves, A Citizen's Guide to the Great Debate Over Tax Reform. Rhonda Fanning produced this half-hour of programming. Chrissy Pease handled on-air production. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. Stick around, another hour to go here on the Ideas Network.